Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. Sorry we're starting a bit late. We're very pleased to have Rachel Cuss with us this evening, freshly tanned from a grand tour of Italy. She's going to be talking about In the Fold to John Mullen, who's a professor of English literature at UCL, and I hope she'll be able to sign some of these up.
Thank you, Giles, and thank you for you all for demonstrating your devotion to matters literary in the heart of the summer holidays. I've demonstrated my own admiration for, and relish indeed, for Rachel's novel in a way that few literary critics usually manage, which is I've come back from my summer holiday for the day. And as I was sitting on the Hopper bus from Fakenham to King's Lynn, this afternoon, I thought that I was showing a kind of critical zeal that few writers for the Guardian's books pages demonstrate themselves. Giles and Rachel got something in common, of course, I realised, as I was looking through Rachel's bibliography, which is that they both won the Whitbread First Novel Award, isn't that right?
Oh.
Yes. So which shows that award is indeed the promise of things to come that the sponsors would hope. And many of you will probably know Rachel's earlier novels, including the one that won the award, Saving Agnes. And perhaps also know her writing not just through her fiction, but through her autobiographical book about motherhood, A Life's Work. I don't know if that will be relevant when we talk about In the Fold, in which indeed maternity does come up as a kind of a theme or drama in it. What I thought we'd do is I'll ask Rachel questions for 20 minutes or so and then throw it open to you. And I wanted to start by talking about what a sort of bad critic would call the scenario of the novel, which is the naive or startled outsider who enters a sort of peculiar, eccentric, privileged English family and gets first of all charmed by it, and finally ends up seeing its sort of very bad behaviour. And I found myself thinking of other novels, the kind of maybe a sort of tradition of novels like that. I think several people who reviewed In the Fold mentioned Brideshead Revisited, actually. But there's also kind of, it goes back to Mansfield Park, and I suppose more recently Alan Hollinghurst's The Line of Beauty is a bit like that too. Michael, of course, the narrator of In the Fold, goes to live with this extremely peculiar and yet sort of also incredibly peculiar family, the Hanburys, at this hill farm in Somerset, Egypt. And I suppose I want to start first of all just by asking you what the interest of that scenario of going into a family was to you?
I think it came from all sorts of different sources, but I think probably the sort of driving force of the sort of scene setting of the book was my sort of feeling that I had written a lot about the sort of visceralness of female relationships, of mother-daughter relationships, of the experience of motherhood, of a whole different way of a whole different sort of experience, I suppose, of being and relationships and sort of humanity. And I wanted what seemed to be to me a more sort of male sort of version. One sort of definite kind of root of the book was the sense of the sort of male version of parenthood, which is, I mean, that, you know, that is very much a sort of part of In the Fold. The sense of the sort of male character being the almost like a sort of in relief, you know, the thing that is sort of the image that is formed by the sort of woman and the whole experience of parenthood, the male as the sort of, you know, impress of that. So that was one sort of route. Another was my sort of feelings about Englishness, about what the English are, the ways that they talk about themselves, the ways I mean, we were living in the countryside, and I, having sort of been in London, I was very struck by how sort of familial the English are, how much they talk about their families, how much there's a sort of mythologizing that goes on about families that seem to me almost the sort of offspring of our sort of class system, of sort of aristocracy, a way of sort of talking about yourself or aggrandizing yourself. And I mean, those two things came together in the book in the sense that that was something that a man might be very susceptible to, that a woman mm-hmm. would take a more sort of physical, biological route through life, that a man might have a more fantasizing, illusory, sort of conversation-based sort of view of sort of human values. And I mean, that was really what I wanted to...
I was trying to think when I was rereading it earlier today about what it was that was sort of English, as you said, about this family and the way you represent them. Because what you say, I can completely see, but then I sort of was thinking, but aren't families sort of dynastic and self-conscious and self-aggrandizing maybe in other countries? I don't, you know. And yet the Hanburys seem so recognisably weirdly English. And I thought the quality, I don't know, there's a combination of something which I sort of thought, and which I confess I have encountered, I know that's again a bad principle of criticism to say, well, yes, I've met this. But it's that combination of being apparently frighteningly unhampered, unhindered in what you say. So they say kind of rude or revealing things straight away. And there's no, hello, Michael, how are you, and what do you do, or anything like that. And yet they're completely, what's actually really going on is completely sort of mysterious.
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is. I mean, I sort of felt with this book that perhaps there were sort of literary traditions around that it was sort of bypassing or not or sort of visiting. It didn't arise out of those, but I think that they arise out of some, you know, fundamental truth about the way England is set up, the way it works, which is very, very sort of a very fertile terrain for sort of black comedy. And, you know, I mean, Evelyn Waugh is a sort of good example of that, but there are many, many others. And, I mean, I'm not sure whether as that type of family life is lived, I'm not sure whether the comedy is apparent in the actual experience, whether, you know, it's that funny when you're there. But
it's terrifying to be there, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean,
it
offers itself up. And I mean, I was very sort of careful in the book to structure it. I mean, it has a very symmetrical structure to me. And I mean, I have the Alexander family, Rebecca's family, as the more sort of urban, younger version of really the same thing, which is the sort of verbal violence, the various kind of clannish sort of hatreds of or sort of embarrassment about sort of certain behaviours and the sort of showing off, the desperation to kind of come over in a particular way. So I wanted to sort of say that is something all sorts of people can be like that. It isn't just the poshies on the hill. It's everybody.
But that it is verbal, but it's, you know, even when they say, I mean, there's this great, I'm sure lots of people here remember it, the great first conversation when he comes in, and they just say, that even when they say to him, can you drive? You know, it's sort of, what's the first thing they say? He arrives. Would you have brought 3 kegs of bitter for a summer party? That's the first thing that's said to him. And then they give him the car keys. Take my car, go down to Doniford for some wine. We've got to shut these women up. We've got to silence the harpies. And it seems to be a sort of I mean, dialogue of that kind is very important in this book. It seems to be a kind of dialogue which relies quite a lot in his, in your narrator's sort of non-participation in it, almost.
Yeah. I mean, the dialogue was is the sort of backbone of the book, or more than that. I mean, it's the skeleton of the book. And, I mean, I had sort of read a lot of Chekhov and felt that the sort of the play-like, freestanding dialogue was an amazingly sort of expressive structure for to talk about people acting out of total sort of class consciousness, land consciousness, everything other than sort of real self consciousness. It's almost like you can sort of read everything. If you want to talk about a nation, its class structures, its, you know, attitudes to rich and poor, its morality, I mean, and particularly the English, as I've sort of said, I think if you can just analyse the way that they talk, if you can have, you know, them talking, you know, that's really the sort of optimum kind of surface. You know, you're never going to be able to tell people that sort of this is what they're like. And I mean, I think that is something that Chekhov totally demonstrates about, you know, people in this very sort of rotten, sort of declined state of their culture, that really them talking is, you know, that's how you're going to sort of reveal the most about it, because it's not really alive anymore. It's a dead thing that has sort of ended in conversation.
Well, there's that strange, there's that it's sort of symptomatic moment I didn't really register when I first read it, where he arrives and he finds a sort of almost a ménage à trois, the father, his friend's father, and his ex-wife and his second wife, and they're all, and the two wives, as it were, seem to have some perhaps conspiratorial relationship between them. And he says, doesn't he, to his friend, or isn't it a bit, I can't remember, something much better than this, of course, but so isn't it a bit tricky? I mean, some, you know, other people would normally find this a bit difficult. And Adam says, how boring of them. You know, but actually, and so that's kind of the surface these people have, where they're sort of above, and kind of wonderfully believably.
But actually, conventional.
But there is this terrible kind of not just hate thing but beneath it, but there's actually a kind of, there's plotting, isn't there? There's a sort of plot of, and at first you think, oh, the first wife and Paul have hatched it in order to get the money off the second wife, and then it turns out the second wife got the property off the. So in
sounds
fact,
very exciting.
It is.
I'm not sure it is that exciting, but yeah, I mean, I'm probably, that's a little bit more plot than I would usually. Or plot of more raciness than I would usually kind of have, in, but I mean, I think it probably isn't sort of stretching the truth either. But I really sort of used it to. I wanted to get the sort of issue of corruption in family life, of the morality of families, and that was. You know, that sort of the contrast between a group of people desperate not to seem conventional, which is Rebecca's family is very much that. There's nothing actually wrong with them. They haven't, in fact, done anything wrong as far as Michael can ascertain, but they have the identical terror of seeming to be boring and conventional.
Yes, yeah.
And in the case of the Hanburys, it's possible that they have done something wrong and been corrupt in some way, which, I mean, that was a very sort of deliberate sort of difference between those two scenarios.
And did you want to write a kind of anti-pastoral as well? Because the representation of country life is quite a sort of,
yes.
Well, you've got this opening section where he visits as a student, and then we go 16 years into the future, And in that opening section there is that kind of rather sort of bit weird, so magical doesn't catch quite catch the weirdness of it. But I mean, it seems an extraordinary and beautiful.
I didn't know whether that was, a lot of the sort of function of kind of Michael as a narrator is it's really to talk about how a sort of book gets written, how something becomes a work of fiction, how that can actually be a state of mind in some way, or a way of looking at your life. And when it came to sort of the idea of nostalgia for some sort of better past, I didn't know whether that was, I mean, I wasn't clear entirely as to whether that was something that I suffered from or was actually true, whether my perception, which is of a sort of marred nature, a marred landscape, a tainted landscape, but tainted by all sorts of ways, whether that has occurred in the last 20 years or not. I feel that it has, but perhaps people
have always felt that.
Well, have felt it in the 20th century, because I mean that has happened to a degree. I mean, since the Industrial Revolution, but perhaps it is, you know, in that part of your life between being a sort of teenager and being, you know, turning sort of 40. Maybe, you know, there is some parallel kind of experience of feeling that some irreparable sort of harm has been done to your sort of environment.
Because you have. Adam, the character, the person through whom your narrator comes into this family, you have him on the one hand being a sort of thinking that he's an inheritor of this special place, and he's scornful of the farmer down the hill who doesn't know how to do it and who poisons the land and who's going to build all sorts of appalling to let things. But on the other hand, he likes to live in a sort of Barrett home.
Yeah. I think that's probably quite true to life. But, I mean, I never know the answer to this myself, and I mean, it is, you know, for me, therefore, a sort of worthy subject for fiction is whether there is anything intrinsically wrong with what I see as destruction, what other people might see as something else, but whether in fact it's a sort of hapless kind of chaotic process, you know, that leads to things becoming ugly, you know, things being sort of fields being built over, thing, you know, horrible things being, you know, put in sort of old places. Whether there's anything actually wrong with that, and if so, whether that's worse than doing something really immoral, like marrying someone to get loads of money off them. I mean, that's really what I, you know, the question I'm sort of asking in the book is sort of, who is bad? You know, what is bad in this situation? Is it human behaviour? Is human behaviour, is the morality of it what's important, or is destruction, you know, are destruction and ugliness moral issues, or aren't they?
But you've got a narrator. You've got these questions in the book, but they don't kind of come from the narrator ever, do they? Really, you've got a narrator who's sort of, what's the right word? He's got a kind of certain disinterested or perplexed view of everybody and everything, but I mean, you've very carefully made him somebody who's kind of quite remote from what he experiences, and there's one side of that which, in a way, you've already talked about him being a father, and I actually found that quite funny, but you know, with his son, Hamish, who can't speak, who's three, but almost four, and he can't speak, and the father's sort of mildly puzzled and then eventually irritated, stop talking rubbish. But actually, he's sort of strangely kind of alienated from everybody that he meets.
Yes, that is...
That's kind of that's quite a risky thing to want to do, because that sort of I think that's a thing that sort of makes the book in a way harder for the reader.
Well, it's very difficult to write. I mean, it was to get that sort of effect was, I mean, it involved getting everything out of the narrative, absolutely everything. I mean, the most small percentage of things that came into my head could actually sort of go into.
Because he'll sometimes even say sort of scathing or kind of nettled things to his wife, but he won't actually sort of talk about feeling them particularly. I mean, he's even in those extraordinary exchanges with Rebecca, you get the sense of somebody who's kind of, you know, puzzled or, I mean, his wife's completely mysterious to him, actually. Why did you want to take that risk, and why did you want to sort of work so hard to remove those things?
Because I felt that as soon as you, I didn't want anything fabricated to be in the book. I wanted the idea of the narrative as I mean, so often when you read a book that is written in the first person, I've done it myself. I mean, I've written some other books in the first person where, you know, tremendous liberties are taken with, you are not strict with yourself. You're not stringent about it. You're telling a story. If you write something that is absolutely not what that person would have observed, said, thought, come up with, you know, you sort of turn a blind eye to it because it's a novel.
Yeah.
And
that's right. Henry James said you shouldn't write novels in the first person.
No,
exactly.
Really. So my process in this book was totally the reverse. What I wanted was the novel as the experience itself, as an artifact of the way someone would look at life. And I had to have a sort of particular personality for that, for the experience of these various different, for the trajectory of sort of disillusionment and of alienation from one's own experience, the falling for certain myths about things. I mean, again, this is, perhaps I got it wrong, I don't know, but it seemed to me something about the male personality that I very much wanted to have a go at expressing. A certain, it's a difference, it's a distinction that I felt very, very strongly at that particular point in my life that arises around the experience of parenthood, and that the character of Rebecca is your guide, you know, is your sort of touchstone in her sort of total hysterical.
You're worse than Hitler. I have actually once heard a woman say that. not to me, but I mean, you are worse than Hitler.
To her dog, yeah.
You know, and at the time, and at the time, it carried the absolute dramatic conviction that it carries, you know, and at that moment, you know, it's absolutely true to the feelings of it. But that sort of, it seems characteristic, the way the novel ends. Rebecca writes this wonderful letter for the capital letters and exclamation mark. I think it has a lot to do with your family and your fear of disapproval, your fear of really living. Your need to be close to dangerous people, to people who are dirty and vibrant and alive and who really feel. And it gets to the end of this letter where she's telling him that she's leaving, and she's also leaving the child. And brilliantly, she says, kind of that wonderful sort of, not just a disingenuous cliche, but a comment for which there's no evidence anywhere in the novel. I'll say one thing for you, Michael, you're a bloody good father. And then she signs off, you know, with this. And it says, he says, I lay back on the softness of the bed and looked at the ceiling. Then I went downstairs to find Hamish.
So you're a good father.
Well, yes. But the absolute sort of non-registering of any response to that seems...
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good way of ending, but it also seems characteristic of...
Yeah, I can't get at what you're asking.
Well, why...
Does he exist?
Well, I suppose what I'm getting at is why you thought it was so, yeah, just why you thought it was important to risk having a narrator. I think, in a way, you know, I mean, kind of reviewers and people say, I wish, you know, the narrator, I don't really like this narrator. You know, it is, the character's really, but this is narrator, he's horrid, and he sort of talks in a funny way about things, and he has these kind of strange, whimsical comparisons and analyses, and I think that quite a lot of, I suspect some readers, but certainly kind of quite a lot of critics, sort of slightly bridled at that. I mean, I thought it was fascinating, but quite sort of difficult as well.
Well, I think, I mean, the point I made earlier about sort of fabrication is, I mean, that's really sort of my answer. I mean, if you're asking, you know, does he exist? Well, I don't know, but I mean, characterization is a. I mean, one has one's own sort of aesthetic sort of system about it, and to me, it is the most important thing. It is, you know, to be to write something that is by its own sort of light, true, not invented in certain sort of senses, is what I try to do, even if people don't particularly enjoy it or understand it or find it sort of easy. It's really that, it's in the difficulty, and particularly with this book, that is absolutely the case, that it is in the difficulty that the sort of subject matter lies, and it isn't, you know, perhaps those, you know, that version of masculinity perhaps isn't something that sort of every reader would recognise, but for me it is an illustration of something true, of a true difference between men and women.
Yeah.
That, and I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about the difference between men and women and whether there is any, and why everyone says there is, when in fact the things that they say are differences aren't differences at all, they're conventions. And so I just wanted in the situation of Rebecca and Michael, the repudiating mother, the woman who will not take control of the gender relationships, you know, the man that gives rise to, the exposure of maleness that results in, that was what I wanted to, and combined with fantasies about family life.
It's like the most shocking thing, I think, that and the strangest thing that Rebecca ever says, amongst the many strange things she says to Michael, is actually when she says to him, it's in one of his phone conversations when he's down in Somerset, and she says to him, oh, that's right. She says, I miss you. And there's kind of, it's the only, and then she says, though I think it's good for us to be apart. Do you? Oh, absolutely. It's what you always used to say, that the loosest ties are the strongest, and so on. But it's as if, I thought this about, I mean, this is a way into asking a question about sort of marriages and relationships in the novel, which I suppose is also partly influenced by my reading The Lucky Ones, where I thought it seemed like there were marriages in that, where you sort of wondered, almost idly, I wondered what attracted those two people to each other originally, because it's forgotten and gone. And I wondered that with all the marriages, I think, in this novel, that there was no longer any kind of glimpse, really, of what it might have been, beyond maybe convenience or money, actually, in the case of sort of Vivian and Paul, what actually brought them together.
I think there's an exception to that
I think the Adam and Lisa relationship, it's fairly sort of clear what... and I mean, that's really the sort of alternative that to everything else. I mean, to me, that, I mean, that is the unbeautiful relationship that, that in the end sort of probably does less harm than some of the other ones. I can only sort of, I mean, in terms of that sort of material for the book, I write about what I think human beings are like, what I think people are like at the moment here, and to an extent that is what I think they're like. So I mean, that's one, maybe that does mean that my sense of the politics of relationships, the politics between men and women, completely conceals or sort of obscures the issue of love. I think that's something that people feel in their lives very deeply in this moment in time. I think if you ask people what part of their life they, you know, where they sort of act out of love, they would find it much easier to sort of talk about their children probably than about, or even about, you know, their parents or their siblings maybe, than about their sort of husband or wife. And I think that's partly because our relationships have become sort of verbalised to a sort of pretty extraordinary, which again was a thing that I wanted to sort of convey and in the fold, just talking and talking and talking and talking, being this sort of terrible impasse that people get themselves into, where they're, you know, they by, you know, they are confronting endlessly the question of sort of what sort of love is in their life, what it actually sort of means to them, whether they love each other. That is something that I feel is of concern. I feel it's true in some way at the moment, as I say.
Because Rebecca, I mean, part of the so, but. And the most wonderful comedy in the book is Rebecca is a kind of, I mean, she, because you've narrated it from the point of view that you have, she becomes, and because, as it were, the narrator doesn't write out of any apparent animus particularly, she becomes a kind of monster. She's a fantastic sort of...
Well, he does. In fact, there is a point in the book where he says that he half admires her.
Yeah.
For her honesty, for the, you know, the total lack of shame with which she sort of, you know, says these things. And that is true of me as well. I very much enjoy sort of writing those parts of the book because I also rather relished the thought of a woman, you know, you very rarely meet a woman like that, but a woman who is so totally sort of uncaring about, you know, what to me has become a world that is far more conventional for women now than it was sort of even when I was sort of growing up. I think women are, you know, under the cosh in a, you know, in particularly in sort of family life, and I think our lives have, you know, the expectations of us, they've reverted and become more conventional. And so, you know, the idea of this violent character,
yes,
is probably stranger now than it would have been. I mean, you can read Sinclair Lewis, you can read John Updike, you can read all sorts of people who have, you know, women who say and do sort of far worse, you know.
Rebecca bought a pair of boots that looked as though they'd been commissioned to effect my particularly horrible murder. They were black and went up to her knees and had heels like knitting needles. The toes were sharpened to a point that extended 2 or 3 inches out at the front. For a year, she wore these boots nearly every day. She clicked menacingly off to the gallery with her hair in curtains and a devious expression on her face. She mentioned a whole galaxy of men she met there. She charted for me at length their ever-changing positions in the heavens of her favour, where they stood governed by the sun of emotion and the moon of art. I mean, there's a kind of...
daring.
No, it's great. It's great. But having a male narrator, I talked to you on a, you know, where we sort of started in a way. Having, it's not just Rebecca, having a male narrator enables you to do some kind of, are they cruel? There's some sort of cruel, brilliantly cruelly comic pictures of some of the female characters. I think most of the main female characters get that.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably my I just took a sort of break, a kind of brief holiday from general lifelong empathy with women. And I mean, it was, you know, it was the negative, it was the opposite. That was what I, you know, I wanted to get that effect of a world in which women are not sort of driving the language of the book, they're not driving the emotional world of the book, they're inflicting. And, you know, to me, I mean, I'm sort of aware of it, but how often that is not the case, how often narrative is a very sort of feminized thing, you know, even when written by men. There's a sort of reliance on women to feel, to, I don't know.
To sympathize.
Yeah, to provide continuity of a particular, to care, I suppose, to care sufficiently for the book to continue. And I did want a much colder drama. I wanted everyone over there, and you know, a sense of I think that one thing that I've felt very strongly when, you know, sort of as I've got older and had children, and is how your self-consciousness diminishes. There's a particular, I mean, hopefully it comes back again. There's a particular bit of life in which you're so close to the things that you're so, I mean, you're completely taken up with your feelings. You can't think about sort of how you seem to other people, what they might think of you, what the what your behaviour actually is in the sort of wider world. You know, if you're sort of screaming at your child or screaming at your husband or feeling terrible claustrophobia or feeling all sorts of things, I think you can you know, lose a type of perspective that I mean, I wanted to, and I mean, I think again, it's a characteristic of family life. I think these people who spend so much time sort of looking at each other and talking about each other, and you know, they also lose the sense of sort of what they are in the world. So that, you know, that was, I wanted to get that feeling of being nakedly looked at, impartially looked at, really, women and men both.
Maybe I could just thank Rachel very much for coming and talking to us so openly about the book. Thanks very much.